Thank you. I'm glad everyone made it back. So in the next hour and 45 minutes, I want to cover enough material so that you might have a few questions at the end. You probably have a few thousand questions already. One thing I want to go into just very quickly is the key role that control systems play within the media and the scientific community. Now, this sort of surprises a lot of people, and some people are not surprised. First, let's deal with science. One thing you have to remember about science is that scientists are humans first and scientists second, right? All of us. And there are scientists who pose as objective scientific folks who are on the payroll of various agencies. For example, in this cache of documents I received, there's a very famous astrophysicist at Harvard named Dr. Donald Menzel. And Menzel was the chief UFO debunker who went around telling people none of this existed in the 1960s and all through that era. And he was on many panels, and he was the person who would look at evidence and then say, not true, not true, not true. It turned out, I have a document from the CIA where it talks about their contract with Dr. Donald Menzel at Harvard. And it said, but it cannot be acknowledged that he is being paid by us because the public needs to believe that he's an objective scientist telling the public from the perch of respectability at Harvard that this isn't true. So until the time of his death, this wasn't known. Now, in this cache of documents I got in 1994, officially released by the CIA, the provenance of this document is not in question. It names him. So just extrapolate that out, how easy it is to do that. Same thing with a guy named Professor Condon. Professor Condon was the head of the Condon Committee at the University of Colorado that had a contract in 1969 to look into UFOs so that the Air Force could determine whether to close Project Blue Book or not. Project Blue Book was actually a public relations stunt, mostly, to collect information from the public because there was so much outcry from the public of sightings and things that had happened, and the public, particularly Congressman Gerald Ford at the time, was furious that they were debunking events that had happened in Michigan that his constituents said were absolutely right there, here, E.T. craft right here. And Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who later came clean, who's also an astrophysicist, made the famous comment that it was swamp gas. And later, of course, he said we knew it wasn't swamp gas. We knew it was E.T. craft. And he left Project Blue Book as their chief consultant and started the Center for UFO Studies there in Chicago. But Professor Condon, around this time, was asked to head up an objective scientific committee to look into whether there was anything, any veracity to UFOs. There was a lot of publicity around it. And like all government committees, it's always, when they form a committee, they already have it, it's a done deal. It's just window dressing. So he headed up this committee, a lot of scientific people, and Dr. Robert Wood, a Cornell PhD, worked for McDonnell Douglas, now part of Boeing. And actually, Dr. Wood, who is one of our Disclosure Project witnesses, told me, and it's in his very lengthy testimony I have. You have to understand I have hundreds of hours of this kind of testimony on videotape. When he was working for McDonnell Douglas, old man McDonald himself asked him to look into UFOs and gather evidence. And so he began to do this. And he discovered a number of things. A, they were real. B, they were interplanetary. C, they were using a type of gravity control propulsion. And D, most interestingly, in many of the things that he looked into, he found that the ETs had electronic devices that were what I call technology-assisted consciousness and consciousness-assisted technologies, meaning that there was a transdimensional nexus between the electronics of these communication devices This goes at the speed of light. It's just junk, really. It's 1800s technology, and it's the Morse code. No offense, Apple, but they had technologies that interfaced seamlessly with electronics that would pick up directed intended thought, and which is absolutely true. And actually, the founder of Facebook, Zuckerberg, started talking about a thought switch to interface with computers. I don't know if he's been reading my material. But anyway, I started writing about that in 1990, 1991. And when Dr. Wood saw my comprehensive assessment of the UFO subject, which was written in 91, it got kind of moved through the agency and the aerospace community. And I was just starting this project, very obscure at that time, just this country doctor in North Carolina rattling around in an ER. And it made its way over to McDonnell Douglas, and I got this phone call from Dr. Wood, and he said, "You have no idea how right you are. How do you know this?" I said, "Well, I've had contact, and it's quite obvious. I mean, if you're any thinking person, you're not dealing with electronics that are the speed of light, or travel that's the speed of light. It's too slow. Because some of these are from other galaxies, like the picture we have of that one ET that's from Andromeda, 2.5 million light years from here. You know, they're not getting here at the speed of light. It'd take 2.5 million years to get here." So he said, "Well, I really want to meet with you at some point." So we kept in this relationship, and he eventually told me that when he was doing this work for McDonnell Douglas in the 60s, that he was put on the Condon Committee, because they thought, because he was a very prestigious aerospace guy at a major aerospace company, that he would be go along with the debunking whitewash of the Condon Committee. And Dr. Wood was someone who started bringing in boatloads of evidence. And it was turning the committee to the fact, no, these are absolutely real. So Professor Condon went to old man McDonald, head of McDonnell Douglas Aerospace, and said, "You fire that son of a bitch so I get him off this committee." And Mr. McDonald said, "No, I'm not going to fire him. He's a very good man." But he was thrown off the Condon Committee. But he didn't lose his job. But McDonald stood by him. And that's a absolutely true story. And it came out in this cache of documents from the CIA, my God, in 94, that Professor Condon and that committee, some of the key people, were on the payroll of the CIA. And it's in black and white. It's an uncontested document. University of Colorado Boulder, prestigious aerospace guy, and he was carrying water and doing the bidding of the intelligence community, all the time masquerading as an objective scientist. So this is why, you know, I have said, like Seth Shostak and those people who are with SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, they are either the stupidest people in the world or they're on the payroll of somebody to lie to the public. You cannot be that stupid, given the dispositive evidence we put out there. And I actually debated on Voice of America, the head of the SETI project, Seth Shostak, and I had my disclosure project witnesses there. We basically cleaned his clock because the evidence is so dispositive and overwhelming if you go through our material archive. But this happens all the time. So if you just extrapolate, that goes a couple of examples throughout the professorial class and scientific class is how it's done. Now, in some cases, it's done not for payment so much as to protect your own reputation. For example, there was a guy named Carl Sagan. Everybody heard, know who he is? Anyone? Cosmos series and all that. He actually was on the payroll of the intelligence community. And what happened is that Carl Sagan, there were some improprieties in his PhD thesis, which led to the intelligence community reaching out to him. And they basically said, "You're going to tell the public what we're going to tell you to tell the public, or you're going to be washing the floors at Cornell. You're not going to be a professor." And a good friend of his, two of his friends, George Fennell, who co-founded the Extrasolar Planetary Society and founded the Allegheny Observatory outside Pittsburgh, who's on my team, James Mullaney, who is a very eminent astronomer who was the editor of Sky Telescope magazine and astronomy magazine, confirmed to me that this happened to Carl Sagan. And they, one of them told me that he basically aged 30 years in a month because he had to sell his soul to the devil. And so he went from someone looking into UFOs and actually said some positive things about their reality to being a chief debunker of them. And that was a real tragedy because they had what's called oppo research, opposition research, like a political party had. They had dirt on him. And they used it to turn him. But to the public, you know, he was this renowned, respected scientific figure. So just magnify that all through society. That's how it operates. And I know it's not a very pretty picture. It's a little cynical. It's not cynical. It's just the reality. People need to, it's childhood's end here today. Wake up. This is how the world actually works. It's bare knuckle time. And that's one of the big problems is that the same thing happens in the media. Everyone thinks we have a free press. We don't have a free press. We have a free press about things like the stain on the blue dress or something like that. Or other, you know, Kardashian's wardrobe. But on anything really critical like this, we do not have a free press. And I can give you many, many, many examples. I'll only give you a couple. And this involves both the mainstream news media and another one that involves Hollywood. Take this and extrapolate it. Ira Rosen won his Emmy working with Mike Wallace at ABC News. He then became the executive producer, ABC News New York, for Primetime Live in 2020. When we started moving forward with the Disclosure Project, he came out to my farm in Virginia and came out with a production team. I gave him 35 hours of top secret testimony and countless top secret documents. And he says, either this is the biggest hoax in the world or the biggest story in human history. And he says, I think it's the latter. I said, it is. He says, we're going to do a series of town hall meetings with your witnesses, and we're going to do a huge expose on this. I said, I don't think ABC will let you. And he said, I'm the executive producer, and I have final decision over this. I said, Ira, I don't think they'll let you, but I'll cooperate here. You know, here's 20 years of research and all this effort. You can have it on a silver platter. No payment. I'm not a consultant. I give everything away for free. So he goes back to New York. He takes me up there. You know, there's Diane Sawyer and all these guys. Well, you know what's interesting? I said, well, if you can make this happen, it's awesome. So a couple weeks later, he calls me up rather sheepishly. And he says, Dr. Greer, they're not going to let me do this story. And I said, well, Ira, I thought you said you had total control over programming for Primetime Live. He says, Dr. Greer, not for this. And I said, well, who are they? He says, Dr. Greer, you know who they are. And that was the end of it. And we've stayed in touch. He's now back with 60 Minutes. But that was one of the reasons why many of you may have remembered that Mike Wallace went on Larry King Live and had a deep depressive breakdown. And he talked about, he kept saying, I was a fraud, I'm a fraud. And part of it is that a guy named Schwartz, who was on the board of Time Life, and I met, and he was very good friends with Mike Wallace, and Mike Wallace had gotten hold of a cache of these documents. And I was in New York at a party, and this, you know, Bob Schwartz said to me, he says, look, he said, the media has become the scribe taking dictation from the right hand of the king, and particularly on something like this. And so Mike Wallace, who was this esteemed investigative reporter, couldn't touch the biggest investigative reporting story in history. And he felt like a total fraud and went into a deep depression over it. If you take Hollywood, the same thing happens. The only movies you really see that come out anymore, now Close Encounters of the Third Kind by Spielberg was a docudrama. He was given access to some of the secret files at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That's true. If you haven't seen that movie, go see it. It's classic. But in modern times, that was in the 70s, I think, it just isn't possible. The studios are completely mobbed up with people, just like these scientists who actually are on the payroll, with people that respond to the intelligence community. So Arnold Copel's son was a huge producer who had multi-billion-dollar in gross sales for his movies, flew me out to L.A. He wanted to do an enormous expose, true life story, be like Argo, but based on my work and what I've done. It'd be a thriller. Because, you know, you have murder, you have mayhem, you have intrigue, you have E.T. contact, you have the whole thing. He loved it. And he was there, and I was at, you know, 20th Century Fox, and he had a $60 million discretionary budget to do any movie he wanted, pre-approved, because he was a big name. And I said, well, Arnold, I don't think they're going to let you do this one. He says, oh, yes, I'm Arnold Copelson, and I've done this. And he took me to his vanity wall of all his awards. I said, great, wonderful, give me a call. So he sends one of his chief assistants here to D.C. when we're doing the private closed briefings for members of Congress in April of 1997. And she goes back, and he goes, he said, this is the most incredible bunch of information, because we filmed all that. And so I let him have that closed briefing film. He says, this is going to be the biggest movie. It'll be bigger than E.T. or Close Encounters or any of them. And certainly it'd be bigger than something like Avatar. I said, well, good, do it. So, but I don't know if they'll let you. He says, why do you say that? I said, well, let's see. Just start it down the path and let's see what happens. A few weeks later, I get a call from Arnold Copelson. He says, Dr. Greer, they won't let me do this movie. I said, oh, Arnold, I thought you had the $60 million already in the bank ready to roll. He says, not for this. Fox has killed it, put it in turnaround faster than 10 light years of light speed. So it went into turnaround and got killed. And turnaround means when you take a film and basically kill it. So that's what happened. And it's happened. I give you this example. If I'd be here until tomorrow morning giving you examples I've had with the media, the mainstream media, where this has happened over and over and over again. So one of the problems is the big media do not allow certain things to be exposed. And we have been brainwashed to think that we're the land of the free and have a free press and a free market, etc. But we do only within a certain confine. But ironically, that confine is a prison. Because how do you have a free market if the most important technologies and information of the last 100 years is sequestered and can't be used? I mean, that's not a free market. That's a managed market and controlled, and it is. Same thing with the media. So that's really how that works, and you need to understand that's a very important component of how magic infiltrates and operates. And keep that in mind whenever you start seeing a major media report. And now with the internet, we can put something out and it can reach. Ironically, we can put a video out and it'll have 5 million views and it'll reach more people than Larry King Live used to or most of the CNN talk show hosts get. So luckily, we're able to bypass it now, but back in the good old days. But even then, it's sort of relegated to mainstream. The thing that people respect for their source of news, CBS News, ABC News, CNN, et cetera, and so on, won't touch this in a credible way. And if they start to, and believe me, there have been many initiatives from the Wall Street Journal approached me, wanted to do a huge story, gets killed. So there are operatives that are embedded in the integrated corporations of all of these media holding companies. And it will not make it out. And that has been my experience to date. I'd love to be surprised. Now, that then brings into the question of what about the rest of the sectors, you know, and someone at the break brought up this question of funding, because I mentioned towards the end, well, there's $8.5 trillion now that's unaccounted for. Trillion, not billion, trillion. A trillion is 1,000 billion. So in other words, it's a lot of money. And unfortunately, it isn't as obvious as it seems. And this is where, you know, take the children out of the room. Here's how this actually works. So you have, I mentioned, the sort of storefront with the military-industrial unacknowledged special access projects. And that's, you can kind of steal several billion dollars very easily that way. And each year I estimate out of the Treasury of the United States through these operations, between $100 and $200 billion. Not, you know, a huge amount, but if you look at the military intelligence, Homeland Security, FBI, and there are other people. There was a undersecretary for HUD for Bush, George H.W. Bush, who discovered that HUD money, housing and urban development money, was being siphoned off into these black projects. And she started to blow the whistle on it. She got fired. So one of the things you have to begin to get your mind around is how the unacknowledged special access projects can penetrate not just the intelligence and military, but other agencies, and then siphon off funds. And it, you know, you get a trickle here and a trickle, and it becomes this huge river. Now, there's another second and very important way that funding happens, and that is through monetizing products. Now, what do I mean by that? Let's say that you're Bell Labs back in the old days, or some of these other large corporations, and you're studying under U.S. funding contracts in these unacknowledged projects a technology. And you figure out, oh, this is really what you can do with an integrated circuit and miniaturize it. Or this is what you can, these things we collected off the desert floor in 47 were these little fibrous things that you put a light at one end, boom, it's perfectly transmitted to the other, fiber optics. So you then create a market for it. And you allow some of this out, but there's a huge amount of money made on productizing fiber optics, integrated circuits, miniaturization, microprocessors, things of this sort. So there are spinoffs, and those spinoffs make an enormous amount of money for those companies, even though we, the taxpayers, paid for the R&D, and those folks really didn't invent it. But they benefit from it, from the corporate level. So that enriches the corporation so that it can then self-fund through licensing and productization things that were actually funded by the taxpayer. Now, Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, does this all the time. They take stuff that's being funded at NIH or through university grants. The breakthroughs happen in basic science. They then take it one step further, patent it, license it, and next thing you know, a course of chemotherapy costs you $250,000. That's how it works, like rituximab. So, but that's been done with these high-tech programs since the 40s and 50s. So that's a huge source. So then they have their own funding. But now you can see how they can lift off the reservation away from government even more because they're more independent, corporate. Then there's the banking sector, and this is the big one. You know, the Federal Reserve Board basically just invents money out of thin air. When we had the financial crisis a few years ago, in the mainstream Wall Street Journal, you know, it was admitted they basically injected $17 trillion into the banking sector. Trillion. TARP was a small part of this, $800 billion, not much. This is $17 trillion. They basically, at no interest, gave $17 trillion to the gangbangsters, I call them. Now, they are gangbangsters. And those guys who have integrated, if you look at the corporate nexus between the banking and financial sector and these large corporations and these government agencies, there is a nexus that gets woven. And the real power is really in the financial, macroeconomic level. And they basically can fund whatever and whoever they want and can move money around virtually with impunity. They're too big to fail. And at this point, there's a joke that if you think they're being regulated, this is a joke. So the gangbangsters have learned how to use that system, and they have investments and interest. And startups, you know, whether it's the Blackstone Group or the Carlyle Group and this, you know, private banking at J.P. Morgan Chase and what this and that and the other thing. And so there's this whole labyrinthine system that involves the banking sector. And then there are covert parts of the banking sector. I'll tell you a story of a man who, back when I was working on this and they'd made another run after I said no to the head of Army Intelligence when they wanted to buy my silence with $2 billion in slush fund money. I was taken to the Wrigley Mansion in Phoenix one night, and it was a late night meeting, maybe 10, 11 o'clock, and there was a whole group of people. It was like a conference for boardroom in this mansion. And around the table were a whole bunch of suits, and most of them were corporate, a couple government. And they say basically to me, you know, they said, you don't need to bother with someone like the president or the CIA director. They don't know anything, and they're not going to know anything. You need to be meeting with people like, well, us, who do WFO, work for other programs for the government. And there are certain orders of Jesuit priests who are involved with technology transfer policy. I said, what? I thought they were on drugs. And it turned out every word they said was true, and I was just listening. Be an interesting movie, wouldn't it? Anyone has cojones to do it. Then they started, this one guy pulled me aside, and he said, you know, we've checked you out. You're a doctor. You have good credit, good income. Take out as many platinum cards as you want. Give them to me. We will then zero out the account balances every month. So you can spend several million dollars a month, and we'll just zero it out. Now, you put me under sodium penalty. This actually happened. And I said, well, then you would own me, wouldn't you, Jim? He says, oh, don't look at it that way. We're here trying to help you. I said, no, you would own me. This is fraud, banking fraud. And he says, no, well, you know, just look at it as a friendly hand helping you out. I mean, it's friendly, you know. Devil with forked tongue. And then he started to explain. He says, you know, there are a lot of creative ways where we can get money when we need to. And this guy headed up some folks who do the backup computers for the banking system. And these are big supercomputers. And basically, when you have trillions of dollars daily going back and forth in currency exchange and transactions, there's an odd amount left over that's less than a penny or less than a euro or less than a yen. That gets dropped into a black fund account. And it's a lot of money. It adds up on a daily. If you take 365 days in a year, you've got a lot of money from that. It becomes billions, tens of billions. So you have the black budget, unacknowledged projects. You have the corruption and fraud within the government system. You have the productization, monetization of things that we're paying for the study that they then monetize, like integrated circuits and cell phones and fiber optics. Then you have the banking corruption. And then you have the pièce de résistance. And the one that is the most disturbing, and that's drug trade. So the worldwide drug trade, cash and carry, bigger than oil. And when I first heard this from an attorney who was representing a man's family whose husband, a Marine colonel, was murdered because he saw them offloading drugs at a military base in California, I thought this was a bridge too far. I did not actually believe it. And this attorney, a very, very credible guy, Harvard Law, was representing the family to get them to exhume the body because the body was, the death was deemed a suicide. And the family knew the man had been murdered because of what he saw, because he had told one family member what he saw. And he was at the wrong place at the wrong time in a restricted landing area, in a restricted facility, where one of our aircraft was offloading a large amount of drugs that would then be sent out through various drug cartels and whatnot. And they killed him. Because of what he saw, made it look like a suicide. And I filed that away as data point one. Then I had another data point come in of a woman who owned a 5,000-acre sheep ranch in South Dakota, of all places. But adjacent to it was what had been a chemical weapons storage area and an underground facility. And she had enough resources that she had her own people go out with night scopes and found that there were ARVs, so-called alien reproduction, these man-made anti-gravity things going in and out of this facility wee hours of the morning. And then she got someone close enough who saw that they were offloading huge amounts of chemical weapons, armaments, and drugs. So arms shipping as well as drug shipping. She contacted Senator Daschle, the senior senator of South Dakota, who started digging into it. He got threatened personally. I have a whole dossier file on this in my vault. And he backed off of it. He ran from it light year, at the speed of light, to get away from it, because they made it very clear, stay away from this, Senator Daschle. He said, I can't help you anymore. So she reached out to me saying, can you help me? Because part of what was happening is that some of these chemical weapons that were stored there were leaking into not only the groundwater, but and where her sheep, and a lot of them were dying. And it was like these containers that were corroding. It was like a Superfund site, but classified. It was a disaster. And that's why she was so concerned. She had 5,000 acres. And I said, look, you know, I'll make some calls and see what I can do. But I've got a heavy lift here I'm doing on my own besides your sheep. But this is a very real case. Then on the day after I met with and briefed the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I got a cryptic invitation from two men. My wife and I call them Mr. Allen 1 and Mr. Allen 2. So not their name. It was our code name. I don't want to talk about who they actually are until they're deceased. I can confirm they're deceased. And they invited me over to this condo in Crystal City near National Airport, which turned out was the home of a former congressman who was sort of a consigliere and sort of advisor to George H.W. Bush. And in the room with him was a burly man who was a Science Applications International Corporation executive who was living virtually in retirement exile in France, who had come in for the meeting. And it was shocking what I learned, but not so shocking given what I've just told you. But they said, do you understand how dangerous this group is? I said, yes, I do, personally. And they said, but do you understand what they're really doing? They're destroying our world. They're destroying our planet. They're destroying our country. And these are the ones that have gotten off the reservation even from George H.W. Bush and have escaped control, gangland style. I said, yeah, I know that there are special compartmented operations that are unacknowledged that aren't even under the control of MAJIC anymore, MAJIC. They said, yes, there's a big one, and it deals with drugs. He says there is an army of 8,000 men that are special operations folks, and they said that they move drugs all over the world and the country, and we have killed 2,000 of them, murdered them, thrown them out of helicopters, missing in action, because of minor infractions in security, or a hint that there might be. 2,000 of the 8,000. And they began to describe this program in detail, and I listened. And they said, you know, so this is part of the problem you're dealing with. And by the way, to connect the dots, this is why we don't have legalization or decriminalization of drugs, which every health policy person knows. You can buy anything on the streets of any little town in America. It needs to be, you know, I mean, it needs to be something where there's treatment, education, what have you. But if it was made legal, you would take away an enormous part of the funding for this criminal cartel. And it is the biggest criminal enterprise in the world. So one of my attorneys said, you know, what you're really describing is a transnational RICO, racketeering influence corrupt organization. I said, yes, of course. He says, well, you know, civilians can mount outside of the government a proceeding against using the RICO statutes, basically, which was set up for the mafia. I said, yeah, if you know an attorney that has the courage to do it, let me know. And this gets into something else that could be done. And with the information that we have and the people that could be asked about. And that is a major investigation with a whistleblower act result. What do I mean by that? The Federal Whistleblower Act allows for someone to blow the whistle on illegal and corrupt activity. And what is recovered or exposed through that whistleblower, the whistleblower gets a percentage of. In this case, we'd be talking about billions of dollars. So if there's a legal team that wants to head this up, and some more whistleblowers that we can put together, that's how you could fund the Energy Lab, but it would be a very big lawsuit and project. It can be done if there's anyone who has the wherewithal to do it. I've mentioned this to a few attorneys, and then when they find out who you're really taking on, they go, no thanks, no thanks, no thanks. So it's all about courage. You have the courage to take on this sort of Fourth Reich that's really running these projects, this neo-fascist transnational security state. But that is another big part of the funding mechanism. And there are others, but these are the big pillars of how you get funding for an unacknowledged special access project. It isn't nice and it isn't pretty, and then it ends up doing things that are completely out of the control. If we go to the next document from Prince Hans-Adam von Liechtenstein, this is going to get heavier and darker for a little bit until it gets better. Just bear with me. You know, I don't know if you know who this is. Liechtenstein is a big banking empire. And kind of they funded a lot of Adolf Hitler's work. And the crown prince is their king. So this is a man that I've met with and known for a number of years. I think this is dated 1994. And Hans-Adam von Liechtenstein, the first time I called, I was asked to call the castle, his butler or someone picked up, and then he was immediately put on, and we talked, and he says, well, I don't want to talk on the phone too much, but we should meet. And these letters, this and the, you can go to the next one also. It was maybe a month later or something. Was from the castle, Vaduz, and this is the actual letters. He basically said to me, you know, let's get together. And I think he was wanting me to come to Europe. And I said, well, I'm too busy. I'm working as a doctor. And then it ended up, and although it's not reflected in this letter, he came to New York and stayed at the Four Seasons hotel there in Central Park. And so he invited me over, and I had a meeting with him. But he says, from what I know of your assessment is correct about the group, this cabal, which is controlling the issue we discussed, UFO. I suspect they have very good reasons not to inform the public, and therefore I am highly skeptical about your chances of success. But he still wanted to meet. So I said, okay, let's meet. So this is where it's going to get into some shock and awe. I go 94 in July. I go up and meet with him at the Pierre Hotel, Four Seasons. And the reason he didn't think it could succeed is that he told me the ETs wouldn't allow it. They wouldn't allow disclosure to happen. I said, excuse me, we're making contact, and it's clear that, you know. He said, well, let me tell you what happened. So he was involved with a lot of UN programs and also with George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, and a man at the UN named Perez de Cuellar, who was the Secretary General at the time. I had done briefings with the predecessor, the one after Boutros Boutros-Ghali. And he said to me, the reason I on the phone told you that it wouldn't be allowed isn't that it wouldn't be allowed from the point of view of the government, but the aliens won't allow it. I said, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, since we've been talking, we've gone down to Mexico, had a craft come out. I said, they're obviously wanting to make contact if we do it in a peaceful way and not a military way. He says, well, this was attempted before you started your organization. I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, in November of 1989, in the fall of 1989, President Ronald Reagan, Mikhail Gorbachev, Perez de Cuellar, and himself, this guy, and others met with on a committee, very sensitive and classified, to organize basically what I did with the Disclosure Project, to announce that we weren't alone and end the secrecy. And he said what happened is that Perez de Cuellar, the Secretary General of the United Nations, was coming back from a 3 a.m. late night planning session for this event when he was abducted by aliens from his motorcade in Manhattan. And I said, oh, really? And he proceeded to tell me the gory details of what happened. So Perez de Cuellar was taken somehow out of the motorcade onto an ET craft where he was threatened by the ETs and told, if you disclose this information, we will abduct every world leader involved, including the President of the United States. Now, this is from a person who was at the table for this planning session, to my ears, now to you. And I went, oh, come on, really? And he said, yeah, it blew up like an atomic bomb in the Bush White House. Subsequently, I found out that up at Kennebunkport, there were all these UFOs zipping around when Bush was up there out on his cigarette boat. And they didn't realize they were ours. So now we're getting into false flag 101. Up to and including being able to deceive members of MAGIC. And it took me a long time to get to the bottom of this mystery. Now, people like Bud Hopkins thought it was a real abduction case. And I looked into it, and I found out that if you go back to the Roswell event, there was a red-headed sergeant who was the badass guy who threatened to kill everyone, all those ranchers who saw this thing crash. His son became a part of MAGIC security, this renegade group, this splinter group, who was involved with abductions and stopping leaks within MAGIC itself. He then went and was in the security detail that night and set up the electronics for this electronic warfare abduction of aliens. It was all a hoax. It wasn't ET at all. It was 100% military ops. And so we're going to get into this in a moment, well, how these operate. And so Perez de Cuellar, of course, not knowing about that end of the classified world, and I would say Papa Bush neither, thought it was actually ET. And it blew up, as I said, like an atomic bomb in the Bush White House. And Gorbachev, they pulled the plug on the plans to do disclosure and end secrecy in 1989 at the end of the Cold War. And I think it's strange that in January of 90, 2 months later, is when I had a contact event at my house in North Carolina with an ET and that said basically, pick up what you've dropped. Do this, what you left and behind as a teenager. Pick this up again. Someone's got to pick this up. But maybe that's a coincidence. But Perez de Cuellar thought that that was an actual alien abduction. And I said, well, with Your Highness, with all due respect, there are technologies that would facilitate this kind of deception. And the military term, so you know it, is a false INW, or a deceptive INW, indication and warning. And it's basically like the, you know, Gulf of Tonkin event in Vietnam. You basically exaggerate or hoax an event that then manipulates policymakers. So this was the ultimate takedown of official disclosure, which was about to happen in 1989. Got it? 26 years ago, November 1989. So here we are in 2015, and it took a lot to piece all this together, and I began to look into what the electronics were with this and what kind of technologies they might have. And one bit of insight that the prince had, he said, you know, so he told me that the reason he was funding the abduction groups is that he was convinced that there was an existential threat from outer space. That's been the Sub Rosa plan since the 56. And that he wanted people to hate the aliens enough to pay the blood and treasure of World War III. And he also wanted it to be eschatological, where it would result in the end of the world so that Christ would return and the good folks would go up in a flying saucer, I guess, with Christ. Now, this is what he was telling me. I'm just listening. And I'm going, whoa, this is like, woo-hoo. And he was completely convinced that this is what needed to happen. This sort of end of the world eschatology is the study of the end of the world event. And that's why he was putting so much money in and providing so much funding to Mack and David Jacobs and, you know, Bud Hopkins and all this. And he told me, I'm going to stop funding John Mack because he's become too positive about contact. And I only want to fund people who are going to put things out there that scare people and make them hate the aliens. He said this. So I went, oh boy. Now this is connecting a dot that all of you better listen to very carefully. It's the last thing you learn today. And that is that there is an overarching agenda that was hatched in the 50s. Remember that psychological warfare document and its value? That was hatched between 53 and 56 to create the specter of a threat from outer space that does not exist. Wernher von Braun stated on his deathbed, and we have the testimony of his assistant, that he said they will first have the Cold War, then we decided there would be nations of concern, then global terrorism. We have this testimony from before 9/11. Then that would be followed by threats from outer space. They'll start talking about asteroids and things of this sort, but the ultimate one they're going to play is the alien threat, and it's all a lie, and it's all a hoax. But in order for the lie to work, they have had to create a body of disinformation, false information, and frightening scenarios, and actual events that would be convincing to our policymakers like Reagan, convincing to the average person, and to the UFO public that consumes videos, entertainment consoles, movies, etc. And that has been the 50 to 60 year plan. Don't forget that no less a figure than Douglas MacArthur in his last address to the Congress said World War III will be interplanetary. So they have been wanting to provoke an interplanetary conflict for as long as I've been alive, and I'm no spring chicken. All right, so this gets into a huge problem of how people consume information and can be manipulated through fear. Because if you look at the roots of human warfare, the early days and even today, it's people abducting a tribe's women, raping them, abusing them sexually, et cetera, and so on. This is all stuff that they are simulating and saying that the ETs are doing through these abduction scenarios. It is 100% being done by military special operations that are this paramilitary force. And this is the deep end of the pond. Now, when I discovered this back in 1994, now this is 21 years on, I was told by someone in the intelligence community, don't talk about that because that's what's really dangerous for you. And it's also what will discredit you, and it will also cause them to hate you the most because you're defanging their whole war plan. The next big war is not terrorism. It's interstellar. And if you expose that it's a hoax, it takes all the steam out of their plan. I said, yes, but if we don't, we're cooked because there's no way you can have war that's interstellar and survive it. It'd be worse than mutual assured destruction because the technologies are a thousand times worse than a hydrogen bomb. So I said, look, we're going to have to figure out how to deal with this. And the only way I know how to do it is put the sunlight in there and let people know what the truth is. So a man came along. If we go to the next slide. And you probably have seen this. It's up on our website. When we first put it up, it had over 600,000 views. The next day, the intelligence community went in and said there were 6,000 views. By the way, if you believe the metrics on Google and YouTube, I have a bridge to sell you. It's all can be manipulated because it moves you down the search engines. So when this hit, within a couple of days, had 600,000 views. This man, William Pollack, is pronounced Pollack. Was a man, very good man, who gave me an interview only to be released posthumously after he died. And not long, a few years ago, I got a letter from his wife, significant other, I guess. They weren't technically married, with a death certificate and a letter giving me permission. And he had passed away. And I have a lot of these, you know, and I honor my word about keeping a confidence. So what happened is that he gave me this interview, and in it, he talks about the development of RF radio frequency chip implants back in the 70s and 80s. And this, when he was developed, it was totally an accidental thing that happened. He was with a company that developed it. He then got called into the CIA, and they started doing special programs for the CIA to develop it. And at a certain point, Siemens in Silicon Valley manufactured 2 billion of them, with a B, of these RF chips. And the way they work, I mean, they can be so miniaturized, you could eat something with it, it has a radio frequency, and it can transmit not only where you are, but the really advanced ones have a neurophone capability to control thought and behavior. Very sinister stuff. So you can actually do a lot of psychological warfare with these RF frequency chips. Now, that was the early stages in the 70s and 80s. Now you figure, you know, 40 years later, they're more and more and more and more sophisticated. And as I've watched the whole UFO subculture sort of get involved with this whole fascination with abductions and implants, I went, yeah, but you know, EG&G is on one of the plants is on the edge of the Area 51. They're the ones manufacturing the implants that you're taking out of these abduction victims. Absolutely. They're not coming from outer space. They don't need that. If you're interstellar, you're transdimensional. If you're transdimensional, you don't need an RF frequency plant chip to track anybody, because their technologies are way beyond that. I said, this is human, 100%. And you better wake up. And so Powlett gave us this interview, and it was one of a dozen data points that I began to accumulate. And then not many years ago, I get a document, the next one, which is chilling. It's never been shown. It's from the Strategic Studies Institute think tank. And it's dated 1995. And it was talking about all kinds of global security strategies. And, you know, you can look at it yourself. Cult-programmed graduates, blah, 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 who will be expected to participate in contrived UFO abduction scenarios. Listen carefully. Oh, we need the next one up. Strategic Studies Institute. Is it? I can't see the screen. Is it up? All right. So I loathe reading to people, but I will. And number two, create a global UFO cult, which will involve, this is what needs to be done in order to actuate this false flag operation, that will involve the abduction of citizens so as to foster an illusion that this Earth is facing an extraterrestrial invasion. UFO abductees of preference will have an experience in computer technologies, since that expertise will be required in future technocratic RMA scenarios. Use of experimental drugs, holographic projection capabilities, directed energy technologies, I'll get into that in a moment, induced auditory input. These are the neurophones I mentioned that Wernher von Braun said the most dangerous thing is the neurophone non-local things that can be done to make people think they're having an experience when they're not. Input experimental aircraft, well, that's just a euphemism for man-made UFOs, and special effects costuming and stagecraft, among other things, will be used to persuade the abductees of the reality of their circumstances. Official denials regarding these events will employ reverse psychology to ensure that all such denials are taken as official confirmation of an imminent and or ongoing extraterrestrial invasion. This is the next page. UFO abductees will be persuaded to worship their anticipated ET conquerors in cult-enforced religious fashion. UFO cult networks would be controlled by U.S. intelligence to limit infiltration and ensure that dissidents do not disrupt UFO long-term agendas. Uncontrollable dissidents will be assassinated, preferably by directed energy means. Dissociative satanic cult graduates will handle all such executions, i.e., when not actively lending logical and theatrical support to UFO abduction operations. Number three, directed energy surveillance and weapons technology of all types and caps will be used for purposes of spreading fear and confusion in the population at large under deniable circumstances, for eliminating persons deemed adversarial to U.S. national security interests, and for spotting, assessing, and manipulating potential recruits to the RMA cause. Neurocybernetics and other psychotechnologies will be used to sow confusion and hypochondria in the population. The symptoms and effects produced by these and other directed energy technologies will parallel the effects produced by various microbes, viruses, and chemical imbalances, thus compelling a large segment of society to seek medical intervention, which in turn will be a basis for their being used for medical experimentation under voluntary circumstances. Psychiatrists and psychologists will play an important role in these experiments, particularly where denying the efficacy of neurocybernetics psychotechnologies is concerned. Citizens who complain of hearing voices will be used as a basis for generously government-funded schizophrenic-related brain research, on and on and on. It goes on. Now, if you're not falling out of your chair yet, what I want to tell you is that all of that has come to pass and came to pass between the 1950s and the 1970s. A man that I worked with before his death had developed an electronic system in 1956 or 54, that would enable someone electronically to remote view anywhere and could also affect, some of these have been called radionic psychotronic weapon systems. And they were developed decades ago. Now, how hard is it to deploy them? Not hard. They're not used every day. They're used enough to create a groundswell of conviction that there's an alien threat. So you take that capability, combine it with man-made UFOs, combine it with disinformation in general about the subject, and also certain chemicals, and you can launch an entire contagion of fear that's based on completely man-made false events. So this is the false flag event I wanted to warn you about. And people say, when is that going to happen? I said, it's happened already. It's already happened. The media, the film industry, any UFO conference you go to is going to be filled unwittingly, usually, not always unwittingly, but usually with information that is this kind of disinformation designed to create an us versus them dynamic of an alien threat. And the reason for it is that that is the only way to grow the military-industrial complex. You know, Leon Panetta, the CIA director and then Secretary of Defense, but when he was CIA director, said, you know, we're spending $110 billion a year chasing down 70 al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan. Ridiculous. In order to sustain the level of expenditures and grow the military-industrial intelligence laboratory financial complex, you got to have another enemy. And as terrible as the terrorism threat is, and it's real, it's nothing compared to what they could do, like in the movie Independence Day, where they stage an attack using man-made anti-grabs that look very ET, with this kind of technology, that there is a threat or an attack on Earth. So, heads up, Wernher von Braun, on his deathbed, warned that this would happen and it would be hoaxed. We've had so many people. I have met with one man, I can't get him to come forward, and then another, and then another, and then another, who spoke of, in the early days, they used, I know this sounds terrible, but he was a little guy, and he was so short, and they basically did, like you would in a movie, suit and head and mat to make him look like an alien. And he would be, there would be military choppers nearby, but he would be on one of these flying discs, man-made, and go in and with a chemical canister and some electronics, abduct people. And he says, oh yeah, I was on an abduction squad. It was way back, I think in the 60s. They've gotten better, and I say better, and they've become more efficient because over the decades they've developed little creatures that look like an ET. They may look gray or like a reptile or this, and they kind of walk like this. They have this robotic, weird walk. And if you look at the, I saw the video that Stan Romanek had of the one that came into his house that basically a film company bought up in Black Shell. Nobody has seen this. I was at his home. And the one that came into his house was exactly one of these so-called gray-like creatures. And the way it moved was this very robotic. It was so obvious that it was a biomachine. And if you go into the brain, it is physical. It has a biological component, but the neural cortex is laced with integrated circuits. And it's completely under control of these military operatives. But he thought it was an alien. I said, well, it was an alien, but not an ET. So I used the word alien, which has a very xenophobic ring, to connote the man-made ones, and the ETs are the ones that are interstellar. The aliens that are man-made are ones that are completely under the control of these paramilitary operations. And the stagecraft, if you use the language of this Strategic Studies Institute document, is so good that it would fool anyone. The president, the CIA, you could abduct, and they did. They abducted Paris de Cuellar out of his limousine using this stuff. And he thought it was ET. And that's why they killed the initial plan to end secrecy at the end of the Cold War. Gorbachev was on board, Reagan was on board, Paris de Cuellar, head of the UN, Prince of Liechtenstein was involved, etc. and so on. Killed it. Now we're getting, this I know is where everyone's going, can this man have lost his mind? Every word I'm telling you is true. This is the heart of the secrecy. How do you convince people there's another species to hate? Now, they actually took this from the playbook of Adolf Hitler. The way they conditioned the population. How'd you get in the 20s, in the early part of the 20th century, Germany was the apex of culture, erudition, progressivity, intellectual pursuits, etc. and so on. How do you get that population to devolve into this horrific community that could engage in the Holocaust? And World War II, the way that happened. Psychological warfare. So the psychological warfare masters that were involved with the German attempt at Nazism got pulled into the OSS fence that became the CIA, and they reside today within this unacknowledged, transnational, deep national security state. So that's exactly the problem we're facing. It isn't pretty. Yeah, I've tried to summarize it in these 3 or 4 hours as best as I can, but it's the truth. Now, as Gloria Steinem said, the truth will set you free, but first it might piss you off. And I think, you know, a lot of people, when they learn that this is what they've been involved with, people who've done research on this subject, get quite irritated because they begin to realize that almost everything you know about the subject is not true about why they're here. Now, what I've learned is being head of the CE5, global CE5 effort. Let's go to the next one. It's a very interesting thing that came out not long ago. It's from the Daily Mail in the UK. But it was an article about this new electronic warfare system. And I actually talked about this 20-some years ago. But they're just now bringing it out. And it's kind of almost like Star Trek, but it's something you can put up that basically knocks out all electronic communication. You have the next one? And it just gives you the idea that if this is being reported in the regular media, or even tabloid media, this is at least 30 to 40 years old. This. And it's basically a platform that can float over an area and knock out all electronics, not only in a city, but over a battlefield or what have you, using pulsed microwaves. Now, this is not talking about scalar. This is pulsed microwaves. But when you pulse microwaves in a certain way, it can cross over into this longitudinal effect, and it can have an enormously destructive result. And this was actually getting reported. So if this is being acknowledged in the media, it means that it's at least 5, 6, 7 generations old. So in other words, this is not state of the art. Anything that's acknowledged in the mainstream media is going to be old, old, old technology. And the really state-of-the-art stuff is highly classified, compartmented, and unacknowledged, most of the really amazing stuff. So this brings us to, how do we get out of this conundrum? And if you see the next, put up the next one. I just want to share this. I share this in my London presentation last month, or in September. And this is the French initiative. And you see the date on it. This is by far, we're about to release all of this with a report on the internet, a document ever generated by a government on this subject. Urgent, 16 January 2007. The French government had decided to reach out to us to make peaceful contact with the ETs and bypass this entire unacknowledged world of cloak and dagger nonsense. And so through a series of meetings that happened over 3 or 4 years, Dr. Moran and his people, a very senior guy, an admiral and PhD scientist, also a medical doctor, with the Ministry of Defense. This is an official Ministry of Defense letter to me and a few other people about this project. And what they wanted to do was to have the protocols established. And with this document came an entire separate attachment that had all the research and equipment that would be needed to do a friendly diplomatic contact with these civilizations in France.